For great-looking t-shirts, hoodies, and sweatshirts, the TNT shop is now open at tntradio.live. This time, it's not the Martians invading. The new truth is more terrifying. War of the Worlds with George Eliason and John Helmer on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome. I'm George Eliason.
And I'm John Helmer.
And this is the radio broadcast from TNT breaking the news of the War of the Worlds. In front of the microphone, you won't be hearing armchair generals and think tankers paid to run propaganda for NATO and the Biden administration. Our microphone is fitted with a special filter to keep the propaganda and false expertise out. This is not the hour for repeating what you've already heard and rehashing what you already know. We aren't a crosstalk of reporters pushing their bylines in exchange for your money. We aren't the BBC's hard talk with its soft-centered confectionery manufactured at the Foreign Office and MI6. They're the alien invaders. This is the hour when you'll be able to hear the news breaking from the news fronts throughout Europe and from your ears to your brains. Not the alien invaders, but the fresh, original human analysis of what the breaking news means. So sit tight. Here goes.
Thanks for the intro, George. A table of contents quickly for our audience. We'll, in the first segment, start with your report from the fighting front in the Donbas. If there's time in the first segment, I'll bring you the latest admissions from the United States government, the Department of Justice, in a document lodged in court on Thursday in Worcester, Mass., against John Teixeira. This reveals rather extraordinary information about his background and raises the question of how on earth he got a secret SCI clearance. If we have time for that, but let's go to you. And then in the second and third segments, we have Chris Cook. Chris Cook is the leading Canadian radio broadcaster of the truth in a country that has lost its capability to distinguish between what the United States and the Kiev regime tell the world and what Canada's interests are. So Chris Cook of Guerrilla Radio will be coming on in the second and third segments. Over to you, George, from the front.
Last Thursday, I was fortunate enough to be invited to go through the frontline towns with the advisor to the Lugansk People's Republic president, Anna Soroka. We started off the morning and we went through towns that, you know, you've been hearing about for months and months and months. Towns like Popishnaya, Stanitsa Lugansk, Kremenaya, and it goes on and on and on. And what was very, very common throughout the towns was, one, the problem that they're having with mining here. The Ukrainians planted mines everywhere in every forest. We went to some areas where they said, don't step off the pavement. And the grass strips between the streets and the sidewalks, there were mines planted. And this was civilian and residential areas. And it was just total destruction. It was total destruction at a scale that I hadn't witnessed before. It's the direction that the destruction came from, which is the horrifying part. Now, these were under Ukrainian control for the last 8 or 9 years. These were their people. These people supposedly are what they're protecting from the Russians. And shelling is directional. You can tell which way it's coming from. And same thing with rockets, missiles. Because of the one, you know, if you look at the building, what side is the damage on? And it was consistently what would have been the defensive side over and over and over again. Entire apartment complexes were brought down on the residences. Residents. In one building alone, they're estimating that there are 200 people still under the rubble, and they haven't been able to get to them yet because it's the middle of a war and there's too much going on. At one apartment complex, there was a forest across the street, and every window in this five-story building, which is well over, I'd say close to 200 meters long, five stories high. You can imagine the number of apartments. And it's a complex, meaning that there are four buildings there with a central courtyard. From the street side, every window that could be hit with the shell was hit. There was no battle there. They sat there with either tanks or handheld weapons, and they fired into every window, killing the civilians. In that particular complex, there was actually one resident left, an elderly woman, who's still living there. She has no other place to go. And she's the last survivor there. So this was recurring over and over and over again throughout every town we went to. And you go into these towns and in cities, these are cities, and 15% of the cities on average, 15 or 20% were totally destroyed. I went to three mass graves. And this is, you know, sadly, again, while the Ukrainians were still in control, the civil government refused to help these people. And as the Ukrainians were pulling out and shelling the residential areas, they refused to help them pick up their dead, obviously. Well, it sounds, yeah, after killing them, right? But this is the town administration. This is supposed to be their government, which, you know, for right or wrong, was set up by Ukraine, installed by the Ukrainian government in Kiev. They wouldn't even take care of the dead. So the residents were taking them to a central graveyard, and they had to bury them in mass graves where they could, or bury them wherever they could. And they're trying to identify the people. And I have pictures of the reburials that have already started, hundreds and hundreds of graves in three cities, just from the withdrawal of Ukraine. In another instance, the Ukrainians came in, they took their uniforms off, and they announced on social media that the Russians are here, we have a central evacuation point, come here if you want to be evacuated. And then they shot everybody that came and left the bodies where they lay. When the whole military operation started, Russia and Ukraine established what's known as a green corridor, which is a refugee corridor they agreed to respect. So people trying to leave, and this was, I believe it was Denitsa, Lugansk. It was horrific. You drive up, and on the left side of the road, they'd cleared the road, but there was a stack of cars, two and three high, for a few hundred meters. A few hundred meters just shot up. These people were just trying to leave. Some of them wanted to go to Ukraine. It didn't matter. It did not matter to the Ukrainian forces were there. Every citizen that left was a citizen, was a person that wasn't part of the human shield anymore. So just like in Mariupol, just like in Bakhmut, just like in other cities, they just laid waste to them with heavy machine guns. Every vehicle was hit hundreds of times. Every vehicle. It was insane to look at. In 2014, we saw a lot of this, especially near the borders with people trying to leave. Snipers would be there. or machine gun nests mowing people down. But this was at a level that I hadn't seen before. Up at the front in Kremenaya, I was, if I'd gone another 1,000 or 1,500 meters or 2,000 meters, I would have been in between the two armies. And it was a humanitarian aid mission, which was why they were there. This was the purpose of going. And it was at a children's home that had a children's music school. And the only building in the area that was hit with shelling was the music school itself, which was laid into just entirely in rubble. They were targeting where children congregated. And this has been ongoing for 9 years. But every time you see it up close and personal, it's just heartbreaking. It really is. And at this point, this makes six of these mass graves that I've been to. Six.
George, can you tell us what prospect do those who survived and remain, and what prospect do the Lugansk authorities who led your mission see for recovery, repair, revival of the area, or is it still too close to the Ukrainian artillery and other means of attacking people? Have the Ukrainian forces been driven far enough away that it becomes safe to start recovery?
It depends on the area. Now, these were all directly within shelling range of the front line, south to north. I asked them about the recovery, and they said, you have to understand that, this is a war zone, this is ongoing. So it's a matter of money and it's a matter of time. Everything will be rebuilt. But we've got to push out further before that can even be considered. They haven't even started on recovery of the bodies under the buildings that Ukraine took down. They can't right now. In that area, that's just how close it is.
And demining, is that an ongoing, or is it still too dangerous for even demining and
demining
disposal teams?
Demining is ongoing. They're overwhelmed with demining because of the just the sheer volume of mines that Ukraine laid while they were there. Entire force, you go into residential areas. I mean, imagine you step off the street to go onto the sidewalk and you can hit a mine there. They literally have to go over every square meter of soil looking for mines. And they're overwhelmed because if you took the entire army right now and put them on demining, it would still take a considerable amount of time. And that's just in city areas. Never mind residential, where the gardens, the fields are all, everything is just so heavily mined. It'll take years to do this.
We're coming up for a break in a couple of minutes, George. Do we want to leave the front for John Teixeira's case, or shall we? Are there points that you think come out of your visit to the front that no one is reading in the West, no one in our radio audience will hear, that they need to hear right now from you?
I've been covering this since the very, very beginning, and I've been off and on at the front line. I never felt any level of hate toward the Ukrainian government until Thursday. with the just the sheer magnitude of what I was seeing. Just the sheer magnitude of it. What they're doing and what they're playing themselves off at in media, it's such a disgusting farce. It by itself is a war crime, and anyone helping them. That's about all you can say about it.
It's difficult for me to suggest we have a commercial break at this point, George. It's very sobering what you've just said. Will you cue the break and let the audience take a breather? And then we'll come back with Canada, the real part of North America that we haven't covered before.
Now, do you have a suggestion for a possible host or guest that you'd like to hear on TNT Radio? Or perhaps you have a topic you feel we should discuss? Well, then we want to hear from you. Simply complete the suggestion form on the TNT Radio website. Help us make a difference on TNT Radio.
TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
Ask Vince Foster, who was found in a Washington, D.C. park with his feet elevated above his head, and yet blood trickles going from his head toward his feet. It's like my cousin Vinny, right? Do the laws of physics cease to exist in your kitchen? How can you cook a grit faster than anyone else? Well, do the laws of physics cease to exist if the body is related to a Democrat? Dr. Gal Luft, who is the co-director of the Washington-based Institute for the Analysis of Global Security, was preparing to reveal explosive information about the Biden family international crime syndicate. Now, suddenly gone missing. Mysterious circumstances. After a court had released him on bail in Cyprus, Luft was an advisor to CEFC China Energy, the same company which paid Hunter Biden about $5 million in 2017 alone, the same $5 million that has been traced to 9 Biden crime family members.
Timothy Shea on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Affordable housing, we can build that. Sustainable housing, we can build that. At MIT Modular, we understand the importance of housing for all and the importance of design, cost, and functionality. Our goal is to meet the needs of our growing population by converting shipping containers to livable units. If you're like-minded and in a position to invest in something meaningful and life-changing, we want to hear from you. We are a team of professional architects, engineers, and financial and tax experts dedicated to offering unique solutions that provide a brighter future. Our Opportunity Zone Fund offers investors both real estate and operating business diversification, 5-year tax deferral on capital gains, annual tax benefits, and ultimately tax-free appreciation potential. There are Opportunity Zones all over America. If you're interested in learning more about our services, need affordable housing, or want to participate in creating a new vision for tomorrow, give us a call in the U.S. on 385-985-5702. Or read more at mitmodular.com. MIT Modular. We can build that.
There is no climate emergency. On air 24/7. This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
We're back. George, you're back too?
Yep. I'm here, John.
What I can say very quickly, because we want to bring on Chris Cook and Guerrilla Radio and Canada in just a second, is that I'll post on the website that follows this broadcast and gives you the playback link, the new 18-page document that the United States government, the Department of Justice, introduced in Worcester, Massachusetts court against John Teixeira on Thursday for some reason. Neither the New York Times nor the Washington Post nor any significant U.S. medium reporting the case of the Pentagon Papers has deigned to give you or give us access to the accusations against Teixeira. They show, and we'll discuss it on the website, not now, no time now, how it was that a boy who was rejected by his local village police department for a gun license has accumulated since he joined the United States OTIS Air Force Base apparat, not only a security clearance, but automatic rifles, shotguns, ammunition, a bazooka, and a silencer. He had a record of these things, according to the government, for 3 years before he got a security clearance. We'll talk about that in writing after the broadcast. But right now, let me introduce Chris Cook. Chris Cook is Guerrilla Radio in Canada, the last remaining truth-telling broadcaster based in British Columbia. He, after leaving corporate news, Chris began a career producing alternative media, first in radio, then migrating into the online world through the Independent Media Center movement and the Peace, Earth, and Justice PJ News site. In 2006, he took on the editor's role at Pacific Free Press News, which was a sister site to the Atlantic Free Press on the other side of the United States. Now canceled, and he'll tell us the story, from his longtime radio platform in Victoria, British Columbia. The Guerrilla Radio endures, producing weekly programs at guerrilla-radio.com and grradio.substack.com. Welcome to the program, Chris. It's great to have you here.
Well, thanks a lot, John. It's great Welcome to speak on, with Chris. You, and nice to meet you, George.
Nice to meet you too, John.
Let's start, Chris.
Sorry.
With a little history. Tell us the history of Guerrilla Radio as the last bastion of truth-telling resistance as we headed into the War of the Worlds. What did you learn from that history?
Well, I can't bring myself to accept that I'm the only one speaking the truth here. There are good people in media here, alternative media mostly, but even in the CBC, the occasional, you know, the cracks do let the occasional bit of light in. But I appreciate the compliment, John. The show, I began it in 1998. As you say, I had worked in news radio over here and found that my stories were increasingly being bled white. And I realized that the kind of news that I wanted to do was never going to be allowed in that venue. So by chance, I met a guy, a retired broadcaster who was volunteering up at the local university station. And he laid it all out for his many long years in radio. He said, listen, they're never going to let you do the kind of stories you want. The way that the whole communication system is set up, it's a couple of stars at the top get all the money, get all the attention, and everybody else spends their careers following orders and picking up crumbs for themselves. And 25 years later, I can't say that he was wrong about that. I started the program. I recorded almost 1,200 programs at CFUV, the University of Victoria radio station, and had the plug pulled, as well you know, last October for talking about things that have been deemed unmentionable.
Do you want to add any detail to what's unmentionable, since you're on a radio show that mentions?
I would love to, but it was very Kafkaesque. I can't say it with authority because the powers that shouldn't be at the radio station wouldn't provide specifics. They actually denied any avenue for appeal. They just wouldn't give me specifics. Now, I know that I was doing a lot of reporting with you and others about the current war going on in Ukraine, and as you might expect, I wasn't following the CBC, our national broadcaster's line, or any of the other corporate news structures that we have here. I was reporting what you were reporting and what George was reporting, and the truth on the matter. And in fact, I've been reporting on Ukraine since 2014. Dean, and reporting on the coup that took place in the Maidan Square and all the things that people that listen to your program already know about, but are still unmentionable in the corporate news here. And even in left, nominally left wing circles, that even bringing this kind of stuff up, you immediately face accusations of being a stooge for Putin or aiding the enemy. And as far as I can recall, Canada never declared war on anyone. So how I can be an enemy of my own state, I'm not sure, for talking the truth about who a place that they've tacitly deemed a rival and foe.
You have an audience in the United States, though, don't you, Chris? I mean, you can you broadcast to North America, principally Canada, but you have American audiences as well. Isn't that right? Are university campus radios also tuning in to guerrilla radio, or did they, or have they left you in or fired you or pushed you out for the same cowardice that University of Victoria did?
Well, the university, Simon Fraser University on the mainland, what we call, I'm on Vancouver Island. Victoria is the capital city of the province. And on the mainland, Vancouver and the major population center, Simon Fraser University is located there. And they have been syndicating my program for many years, and they continue to do so. That's the only university that I'm aware of that's running the program. The show has always been carried out since about 2006 or 2007, has been carried on the internet and is available to anybody in the United States and around the world. When we were on the air, our broadcast signal would reach Washington State, which is our neighbor just to the direct south, but it was a very small station. So depending on the weather, our audience in the U.S. fluctuated. But it's available in all, we live stream and everything now. So as I do, of course, online with my, as I've continued the show, it still goes out over the internet. The reach is difficult to say with certainty, and especially that the shows are archived at my Substack site and at my own website and at the blog for the station or for the show, Guerrilla Radio blog.blogspot.com. So people are listening to shows that I recorded many years ago. They're listening to the shows that I recorded last week. Hopefully.
How would you describe, Chris, are there differences between the American part of the North American audience and the Canadian part of the American audience? Of those 1,200 programs with roughly, say, two guests, so you've had 2,400 guests, which is an incredible number. You've had just about everybody representing the currents of opinion on these major issues in the United States and in Canada and around the world. Is there a difference in the way Canadian audiences respond to you than American audiences? Do you get more or less support from the home folks?
I would say the type of people that I hear back from are of like mind, whether they're on, regardless of which side of the border they're on. Canada is so culturally similar or assimilated to the United States, it's very difficult to differentiate, and that goes along the border. As 90% of the country's population live within 100 miles of the American border, but it also is a political reality further away, where we see in the province of Alberta, which is just to the east of where I am here on the westernmost reaches in British Columbia, the political attitude is often compared to that of Texas, and with their oil interests and cattle and ranching and everything, it's understandable. But they've also had long time links between Alberta and Texas that are even or that are definitely stronger than the links between the province and the federal government in Ottawa, in Ontario. So it's difficult to differentiate, I guess, is what I'm saying, George, that other than the accents, you'd have a hard time knowing who's Canadian and who's American.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. I'm from the Boston area, but I lived in southern Maine, actually, for about 20 years. So, you know, and I've done some work in northern Maine. Of course, you know, you meet a lot of people that, you know, coming across both sides. And yeah, the attitudes are the same. The attitudes are very much the same.
I love traveling in America, and I've traveled, I think, through 27 or 28 states, all, you know, from the deep south to the only place I haven't been, I think, is up in New England. But I've always found the American population to be warm and welcoming and friendly and curious about the world and not resembling its government in the slightest.
And that's the way you think Canadians also think. Is that right?
Well, I think the Canadian writ large relationship with the United States is complex, and it's a long one, and obviously, and we've resisted over history. Your listeners may be surprised to know, even Canadian ones, we've resisted four separate military invasions by the United States and turned them back when the British were running the show here. There's a large part of Canada was founded by the Americans that left after the Revolution, for example, up in George's home neck of the woods there and into Quebec and Ontario. It's a complicated relationship. My grandparents used to go back and forth and work on both sides of the border back in the old days before the border became officialized as it is today. My father went and became an American and lived in the last half of his life as an American citizen as well. The story goes, can be repeated across the country, I'm sure. It's a complicated and close-knit and almost familial kind of relationship. But generally speaking, Canadians find that put on airs of moral superiority when it comes to things like foreign policy, which is entirely falsely. It's a false perception of ourselves that is quite widespread, as it is in the United States as well, where they imagine, I think most Americans, that they're an agent for good in the world, and they're sometimes making mistakes when they blow countries to pieces, but they meant well. Well, Canada is like that, but only more so, where, you know, we say, yeah, well, we were helping our neighbors blow up the countries, but we meant well too.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
What about resistance to... sorry, George, I'll just squeeze in this question. Is Canada's government, the present government, the Trudeau government, the so-called Liberal government in Ottawa, imposing increasing pressure and sanctions and laws to punish dissent and resistance in Canada, which mightn't survive in a U.S. court?
Well, I'm no expert on American law or Canadian law for that matter, but things have changed here over the tenure of our current Prime Minister Trudeau. And you might include that the government here is a minority government. And for the Americans in the audience, that essentially means that the structure of their representatives do not equal a majority in the House. And so if the other parties, and there's more than two in this country, got together, they have the power to throw the government out of office and have an election called to form a new government. But that's another issue altogether. But they're also a minority in who they serve. They serve that razor-thin sliver of society at the very top, where you see Trudeau and is similar to, say, Emmanuel Macron in France or Joe Biden in America, for that matter, who their real constituency are the corporate elite, and all of the policies that they enact are to serve those interests. So Canada, well, the truckers' protest was probably what most people outside of the country saw with horror, and seeing cavalry masquerading as policemen mowing down senior citizens in the streets, peacefully protesting, as the entirety of the truckers' protest in Ottawa was peaceful, no matter what the government or the corporate media here says or how they try to paint it. It was a broad-based, peaceful demonstration against the COVID policies of the Canadian government. And like other countries in the world, with the when COVID happened, they used that as an excuse, as they did after 9/11, the governments, to bring in all kinds of draconian laws that a generation ago would be unthinkable. But here we are, and the Canadian government is continuing in that vein, trying to control the communications online. That's their next target, and they in fact signed just this week into legislation a contentious bill, Bill C-11, that is a worrisome attempt, some fear, to control what people can say and what they can read on the internet.
Can we hold that thought, Chris? You know what it's like. There's a break coming up. Can we hold that, come back to you? And let's go to break now so that the studio can do what it must do. And we have to follow the break.
De-weaponizing weather with reality and perspective.
You can't believe some of the stuff these people actually believe. I don't believe they believe it. We saw a testimony today from one of the administration officials that they want EV tanks. Tanks on the battlefield that are EV. Now, let me get this straight. Just imagine if you're a tank commander. When you yell, charge, it's going to have a different meaning now. And what of those charging stations? You're in a fight with the enemy. One of those great tank battles that used to occur, you know, Rommel, North Africa. Hours and hours and hours of tank battle. What do? Call the opposing commander up and say, hey, listen, we need a truce for 4 hours. I have to charge my tanks up. It's silly time. It really is. And I don't know when the general public of the entire planet is going to wake up to how they're being scammed. This is TNT Climate and Weather Watchdog meteorologist Joe Bastardi asking you to enjoy the weather. It's the only weather you got.
Right of Center USA is working to educate tomorrow's leaders with facts and data-driven policy solutions, and to elect, empower, and encourage politicians willing to fight the corrupt status quo and truly represent we the people, with a focus on ROTC, National Guardsmen, Reservists, and GI Bill collegians. Right of Center USA provides internships that pass along our patriotic values to the next generation. Go to rightofcenterusa.org to learn how you can support its mission of creating tomorrow's leaders today. A message brought to you by TNT Radio.
You're listening to War of the Worlds with John Helmer and George Eliason on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
And welcome back. We've got Chris Cook from Guerrilla Radio with us today, and we're talking all things Canada. Chris, I wanted to get into the diaspora a little bit, and actually how much weight they have when it comes to the government. Now, if you listen to or if you read academic studies by D.G. Rostolinsky Lieb or Per Zanders Rudling, or even a number from just the website and repository Defending History, Ukraine's diaspora in Canada, and this includes the Ukrainian World Congress, control, and even pre-Freeland, controlled Canada's foreign policy, especially when it has to do with all things Central in Eastern European and Russia policy since the 1980s. Now, a link I sent, it was a actual investigation by the CBC into who these people were. And they were actually right at that point. They said that these people, these are Nazis who are still Nazis, will always be Nazis, and they're taking over our governments, our media, et cetera, et cetera. And we don't know what they're going to do with it if they succeed. Well, they succeeded in shutting down the Desezhny's investigation, which is what this was, the report was about, which actually nailed them. They shut that down, and that put the whole thing to rest. How much is the average Canadian aware that they have such an influence there? And they're doing the same thing in America, by the way.
Well, I would say that that's a pretty easy question to answer. I would say that it would be close to zero. And even Canadians that do follow the news are largely unaware. And I would say that's a surprise to me, too. It's pretty much understood from the way I see things that what happens in Canada is dictated in Washington. Washington sniff, you know, if, the old thing is if Washington gets a cold, Ottawa sneezes. I can't imagine that anything is more powerful or more politically influential in this country than the diktats of Washington, D.C. If there's an ascendancy, as you mentioned, in the United States of this Ukraine lobby, there that effect will be acted on here. Freeland is the most obviously the most prominent, most powerful example of a Ukrainian diaspora politician, and she, her biases are obvious and have been for a long time, in regard to her antipathy to Russia, all things Russia and the Soviet Union before that, but. I can't imagine that if Washington didn't want something to go the way that Ms. Freeland wants it to go, that she would have any more influence over it. You know, I you have to understand how overweening the influence of the United States is in Canada, are not only in the economic and political spheres, but in the military sphere, communications sphere. And all things, Canada, even the idea that this is an independent nation is illusory. It's a fantasy. Canada is even less than a 51st state. It's a vassal state of the United States. So it's kind of irrelevant, in my view, what kind of lobbying efforts by Ukraine or Israel, for that matter, go on in this country. Federal policy, national policy, will always be dictated by Washington.
Okay. In terms of the amount and the distance that Canada is willing to go for Ukraine now during the war, is there a red line, or is that just, you know, do you still think that's going to be determined by Washington? And are they willing at some point?
Absolutely. It's going to absolutely be determined by Washington. Trudeau, he has political considerations, and he will commit Canada to support the war until every Ukrainian is dead, if that's what he's told to do. If he's told not to do that anymore, he will turn on his heel faster than the weather changes here on the West Coast, you know, and all of a sudden it won't be happening anymore. Just the other day, Trudeau came out and said that people in this country weren't forced to take vaccination. And he used that occasion to reassure Canadians that they would not be able to sue the government for any injuries that those vaccinations caused them. you know, because he never said it. This is the nature of our leadership right now. But it's not just this Trudeau. His father was Pierre Trudeau, who was also a prime minister in this country and a very prominent one, was equally in the thrall of the United States. He could say things in public and criticize the Vietnam War as he did in that case, while the Canadian government supported the war behind the scenes and profited greatly from it too in the corporate structure here. It's the same in this instance. It's the same in every instance. You know, this isn't a real country. It's a construct.
Chris, my favorite Canadian of all time was Glenn Gould, the classical pianist. And in the 1950s, a story I've told on my website from time to time to remind people of what great Canadians do. Glenn Gould was a young man. He was, I think, not more than 22 when he was invited to play in the Soviet Union in Moscow and St. Petersburg, then Leningrad. And the United States State Department informed Lester Pearson, then the Canadian foreign minister, that Gould should be stopped. And the foreign minister told this young man, Glenn Gould, from Toronto, that he was not to play in the Soviet Union. And Glenn Gould said, shove it. Glenn Gould went to the Soviet Union over the attempts of the United States government and the Canadian government to play what were some of the most remarkable concerts of Bach ever heard in Moscow and Leningrad. Has that spirit ceased to exist? That's the 1950s. Has that spirit ceased to exist?
Well, he was a pretty unique spirit, and not only a brilliant musician, but also a brilliant communicator. And he actually went on to have a media career in this country for years after that, in radio and in the beginning times of television and in film, making documentary films. And he was just a fantastic and super intelligent, engaging individual. He's well loved. That would never happen today. If somebody, he would never get a CBC contract after being politically, he would be canceled. That spirit remains, but the opportunities for people with that spirit definitely are not, at least not in the traditional or legacy avenues of media or in government or even employment today. If there was an equivalent of Glenn Gould, that would be the end of it. That would be the end of him. He would come home and he would be whited out of Canadian history. As it stands, he's one of the most beloved Canadians of a certain generation. I'm not sure how much the younger generation appreciate who he was and what he did and what he stood for. But people of my vintage certainly do. And the simple answer is, yes, the spirit remains, but you know, you'd be buying a ticket to oblivion if you did what he did now in this country.
George, back to you and the Ukrainian diaspora.
Well, you have groups like Pravi Sektor. Now, in the West, it's understood at this point, you know, 50-50. Pravi Sektor, so the actual attitude is Pravi Sektor or Azov might be a negative force in the world.
Yeah.
Do you understand what I'm saying? And they have action dolls now for little kids being sold in America. And the other half of America know they commit terrorist acts. What's the attitude in Canada right now towards these groups?
Well, you don't hear about it in the media at all. Most Canadians, I would say, are entirely oblivious. But Chrystia Freeland isn't. There was a famous photograph of her standing in front of one of the battle standards of, I believe it was Azov, and her staff airbrushed it out of the photo. once it somehow it slipped through, or maybe she allowed it to slip through and then allowed it to be airbrushed out. So she realizes, and she's just as she's tried to airbrush some of her familial history that John has done so much work on as well, so that there is that sort of awareness. As far as Joe and Jane Blow in Canada go, I'm sure that they have very little understanding. I mean, it was some of the other far right elements after the Maidan coup, they were reported and presented in this country. Not only their Nazi paraphernalia, but their attitudes and their actions were covered up until a few years ago, and then all of that disappeared, and suddenly those that mentioned those connections were memory hold or canceled or assailed as being propagandists for the other side.
Does the term fascist? Sorry, go ahead, George.
I just wanted to ask about the name Stepan Bandera. Mm-hmm. And the idea that his grandson, Stepan Bandera III, is out of Edmonton. And he is trying to not just normalize, but make his grandfather, who's responsible directly for the murders in the Holocaust and the Ukrainian Holocaust. So we're looking at about 11 million people. They actually did the murders. Make him a hero and make that name normalized in Canadian, American, and European societies as a good guy. Do Canadians even know he exists?
Well, some do. They haven't named any streets after him here. And the fact that he's in Edmonton is no surprise because of the original Ukrainian waves of emigration to this country. They were channeled onto the prairies. The idea was that they would turn the wild prairie in Canada, they would cultivate it as it is in Ukraine, and it would become the breadbasket of North America, as it was often referred to as the breadbasket of Europe. So you find higher concentrations and a deeper history of Ukrainian immigration in that area. But it has to be remembered too, George, that they don't speak for everybody. Amongst Ukrainian Canadians, they're not monolithic. There's actually older Ukrainian organizations in this country that have an absolutely diametrically opposed view of United Ukrainian Canadians. Who are the powerful and the more powerful lobbying group and organization that have been very militant against Russia, but they are a newer organization, newer than the original, whose name escapes me at the moment. But and they oppose the war. They oppose what's going on. Just as well, I can't tell you anything about what it's like, the Ukrainian population makeup is. But the people from Eastern Ukraine also came to Canada Russian descent, or at least more Russian influence. So it's not a monolith in this country, and there is resistance within the community. But outside the community, I have to admit that the awareness level of Canadians here is pretty low, and I'm sad to say that most Canadians listen to the news and read the legacy newspapers and largely believe that they're being told the truth.
What about the Jewish Canadians, Chris? Mm-hmm. Jewish Canadians whose relatives were murdered in concentration camps run by Bandera and the German army and Miss Freeland's grandfather. Do Jewish mm-hmm. Canadians resist Ukrainian fascism, to use that term?
That's a fascinating question, and I've often wondered why they get such an easy run of it. There's many powerful Jewish organizations politically in this country, and yet it doesn't seem to be on their priority list. Now, that said, I mean, Jews in Canada aren't a monolith either. And all of the many peace groups and the people in peace groups that I've talked to in Canada, individually and in their smaller organizations, they are definitely opposed to not only this war, but war generally. Eve Engler is the most prominent among those, and I really recommend people go to his website, eveengler.com.
Chris, we're running out of time. Time to say thank you very much for bringing Canada into the War of the Worlds and into our program and to our audience. Thanks for
Glad
having me.
Glad to do it.
Thank you, Chris.
Thanks for coming on today.